Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
It's sort of a plot out of Sherlock Holmes or something like that, isn't it? And the fact that she nearly got away with it, you know, and for a while there she must have thought she had.
Hi, I'm Jesse Mulligan and this is Crimes NZ, a podcast where I chat with people closely involved with some of New Zealand's most notorious crimes. In this episode, we're looking into an investigation dubbed the Black Widow Case. In 2014, Helen Milner was convicted of the murder and attempted murder of her husband, Phil Nisbet. New Zealand Herald reporter Kurt Beyer covered the case.
Of the hundreds of cases that I've covered over the years, this was certainly one of the most memorable ones. It just had everything, you know. For a start, you had a poisoning trial that's kind of Victorian, isn't it? So, you know, it could have been out of Dickensian London, but you had this captivating narrative as well with this unassuming figure accused of a sinister murder, a botched police investigation. You had hitmen claims. I mean, it really had it all.
Yeah. So where does it begin? Where does the story begin?
Well, Phil Nisbet was found dead of a suspected suicide, firstly, in his Christchurch home in 2009. His wife, Helen Milner, claimed she'd found a typed-up note on his nightstand, and it went from there. But I guess that was the problem, in that the first cops that investigated it thought it was a suicide from the very start, and that's where things got difficult.
Yeah. And who was he married to at the time? What do we know about his wife, Helen Milner?
Yeah, so Helen Milner was Phil Nisbet's second husband, and they were living in an area of Hallsville in Christchurch at the time. And she was an interesting person. A lot came out about her during the trial, and some of her claims that she used to make about her husband, and they obviously she didn't exactly get on that well with them.
So, okay, so it was ruled a suicide, and that was that. And then what happened?
So when police came to investigate, Milner was very distraught. She claimed to have found a text message on her phone from him saying that he couldn't take it anymore and that he was taking his own life. Now, she found this in the presence of officers, and those first officers thought that was a bit strange, but the detectives who took up the case didn't look too much into it. So his body was found next to bottles of Phenagan, and we heard an awful lot about Phenagan, this antihistamine drug that he was actually allergic to, and it all went from there, really.
Yeah, and at some stage, his sister, Leanne Cartier, got involved. How did that come about?
Yeah, that's right. So Leanne came over. She was living in Queensland. She came over for the funeral. And from the start, as soon as she got there, she didn't think things were adding up. Firstly, she didn't think that her brother was someone who would take his own life. And secondly, when she got there, Milner produced this other suicide note. Now, this one was typed, but it had a handwritten signature, and she thought straight away it was faked. So she decided really then and there that things weren't adding up, and she tried to take her claims to the police, but they didn't seem interested. And she decided that it was a case that she needed to do her own amateur sleuthing on, and she spent the next 2 years trying to pin her former sister-in-law.
Yes, she was devoted to it. This is Leanne in 2014 talking to Catherine Ryan here on RNZ National about what drove her and how much it all cost.
I just couldn't let it go, and I'm not a detective, so I didn't know where I was looking, so I was just looking everywhere for answers. It's probably over $100,000 if I took all my losses in income and things like that into account as well.
Yeah, so she set about trying to gather some evidence, and at the heart of, well, not at the heart, one sort of avenue she went down was a DNA test. Why did she pay for a DNA test, and who for, and why was it relevant?
So she was basically trying to paint a picture of Milner as being a liar, I suppose. So she paid for a DNA test to prove that Ben, his son, was actually his son. She'd obviously been spreading some lies around. And that wasn't the only lie that she exposed. And one by one, she tried to cozy right up to Milner and get her in her confidence. So through text messages and emails, she kept talking to her, kept this correspondence going. And Milner just kept digging her own hole. She kept telling lies that contradicted other lies. And she essentially kept building up a case, and over a couple of years she was able to build a very strong case and then go back to police. But it wasn't really until a coroner took a look at Mr. Nisbet's death that things really took a turn.
Just on this DNA test though, because this is pretty fascinating. So the DNA test was to prove that the victim's teenage son from an earlier marriage was really his son. Why was that even in doubt?
Well, I think this was part of the Milner's backstory. I mean, she really wanted to be out to paint Nisbet in a bad light. I mean, during the trial, she made these outrageous claims of him being a male prostitute and being this sort of lover boy who had affairs everywhere and fathered illegitimate children. It was just another aspect of her character where she just would make these outrageous claims.
Mm. Leanne, as you said, sort of tried to take Milner into her confidence, and she had to resort to some pretty tricky tactics to get the evidence. Here she is describing what she did.
That was the hardest thing to do, you know. It's been totally two-faced, and that's not me. And, you know, all I wanted to do was scream and yell and abuse her. And, you know, I had to be nice. I'd get off the phone and vent then. It was trying to get her to let things go to me in Texas that, I mean, she'd send me emails that contradicted true facts, so that was good. So it was just sort of keeping up that communication, you know, letting her make up more lies and more lies that then she was handing me the evidence off via text and via emails.
Fair to say, Kurt, that if Leanne hadn't been involved, the truth might never have come out.
Yeah, that's probably right. She did do amazing dogged work, and she never gave up. That cost her a lot of money and no doubt a lot of sleepless nights. But she really stuck at it. She wasn't actually the only one who had her doubts. Milner's son, Adam Kearns, he was telling anyone who would listen that his mum had killed Phil, and he had earlier warned Phil that he needed to watch himself, that she would kill him. And Nisbet sort of laughed it off, and Kearns always thought he was pretty naive in that respect. But when cops first phoned Adam and said that his stepdad had been found dead, he thought straight away that his mum had did it. And later when the police officers turned up with his wedding ring, and Adam suggested that his mum wear the wedding ring as a necklace, and she refused. He knew then that she'd definitely done it. And that cost him big time as well, because by then Milner wanted to get him out of the picture as well. So she actually ended up setting him up by sending herself death threats, getting a fake phone and pretending they were from her own son, threatening him, and he ended up spending, I think it was 18 or 19 days in jail, including his 19th birthday over that. So, yeah, it really goes shows the extreme lengths in character.
So he was convinced that his mother had killed her husband, and when she realised this, she framed him.
Yeah, and absolutely cold-blooded fashion. I mean, you know, imagine setting up your own child and seeing them go to jail. I mean, he was still a teenager as well, and he later got a payout compensation award over that. I think it was $55,000 for the way that she tried to frame him and get him out of the picture.
What sort of evidence was Leanne gathering about Helen Milner?
Yeah, so she started talking to anyone she could, really, other family members. She went to the workplace where Helen worked and spoke to her colleagues, and that was when a picture really started to emerge. They were telling her things like, oh, she'd always be talking about killing Phil, and she asked them if Mitre-10 sold rat poison and whether it could kill a person. The trial, while, you know, extremely serious, did have its lighter moments when they sort of laughed it off, really, you know, oh, crazy Helen. They nicknamed her the Black Widow and joked about not eating her muffins at work smoko. but it all built up in a big picture that she wasn't happy with her relationship and that she wanted him out of the picture.
It seems strange. I mean, lots of this story is strange, but it seems strange that if you were planning to murder your husband that you would brag about it at work, ask people where you could find rat poison. In one case, I think, ask someone about paying them to kill her husband. It seems very sloppy considering how much thought she put into other aspects of the murder.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's always hard to figure out what's going through the mind of a killer. But maybe she was muddied at the prospect of, you know, the $250,000 life insurance payout that she might have wanting to get. Maybe she just was one of these people who needs to think out loud. I don't know. But what we do know is that this picture of a woman who didn't like her husband and wanted him out of the picture and was trying to think of the best way to do it, and then nearly did get away with it.
So you mentioned that after Leanne's sort of groundwork, trying to find some evidence for the murder, it was actually the coroner's findings that tipped it over the edge. What happened there?
Yeah, so by this time, Leanne Cartier is getting very frustrated that the cops aren't taking her seriously at all. But in the forum of a coronial inquest, she was able to raise her vast body of evidence that she had gathered. And when the coroner took a look at things, she agreed, but it didn't add up. And she, while she wasn't there to find any guilt, she couldn't find any... she couldn't come to a conclusion that Mr. Nisbet had taken his own life, and that was her ruling. And then by then it had to go back to police to re-examine the facts of the case, take another look at the file, and which they did. They brought in new, very senior and very good detectives, and they opened a homicide probe and started taking a fresh look at things.
Here's Leanne again. She's talking about how the coroner's findings helped.
Formal acknowledgement that then we had something, I had something to push. You know, I was already writing a letter to someone within the police force to say, hey, here's the coroner's report. You guys failed. We need this reopened. She's absolutely wonderful, Sue Johnson. You know, we met with her before the inquest. She took her time in doing her report, but she did it thoroughly, and you know, it came out where the police had no option to turn around and reinvestigate.
This is Crimes NZ, and we're talking about the so-called Black Widow case. With me is New Zealand Herald reporter Kurt Bayer in our Christchurch studio. When did the case sort of come to your attention, Kurt?
It was in that between time where the coroner had kicked it back to police and they were looking at it, and obviously they soon found glaring holes in it. And Milner was living at a different property now in Christchurch, and I went and knocked her door. She was, you know, very much under suspicion. She wasn't very happy when I turned up, and she slammed the door on me. I asked her if she'd killed her husband, and she just exploded. She screamed at me to get off her property and that she was phoning the police. Not in those words. They're slightly more colourful than that. But
to be fair, Kurt, I think if you turned up in most places and asked someone if she'd killed their husband, you'd get that sort of reaction.
Probably fair, but...
that's your job, of course.
It was my job, and within a couple of days she was arrested for murder.
So. Yeah. arrested and charged with murder in October 2011. Took a while for her to go on trial, though.
Yeah, that's right. There was a lot of work to be done to make sure that they had a very strong case. And I think one of the first things that the police wanted to do was to find out where this Fennigan came from, which the first investigation didn't even look at. So they found out that a large box of Fennigan was bought at a Christchurch mall, and it was bought by a woman under the name of... Andrea Wilson, I think it was. Now, that's an interesting name as well, because that Andrea woman was a real person who only a few years earlier had tried to poison her partner. And the cops also found that just a couple of minutes before this purchase was paid for in cash, Helen Milner, her bank card had been used at an ATM machine just a couple of metres away.
So she... Well, it seems that she used the name of somebody who had poisoned their husband to buy some poison to murder her own husband.
Yeah, that's right.
And of all the names you could choose.
Yeah, you might have wanted to pick up a phone book or something rather than do that, I'm not sure. But I guess the next thing was, after she had it, she had to get him to... take it, and a large proportion of the trial was covering how she'd have to crush up these pills. They had a very bitter taste, and how did she manage to disguise that? So there was a lot of evidence about how a strong curry would have been about right, and we had evidence about police officers, you know, trying to different experiments on how perhaps you could disguise the bitter taste. That's what it seems to have happened. While nobody knows, apart from probably one or two people, she had crushed up these sedatives, slipped it into his evening meal. He'd gone off to bed, and obviously extremely woozy, and the Crown suggested at the time that she finished him off with a pillow over his face.
Now, another twist to the story, she's actually already in prison at this time during her trial, and there's two previous convictions at play here. So one is she's been jailed for that matter we were talking about earlier, for her framing her son. She got jailed for 2 years and 8 months for that.
Yeah, that's right. So she got jailed for setting up her son, and she also had an earlier stint on Home D, where this was afterwards as well, from memory, after the Mr. Nisbet's death. She'd stolen $29,000 from her workplace. She was an office administrator at a grounds maintenance company, the place where her workmates called her the Black Widow. So, yeah, it certainly wouldn't have helped her case. From memory, I don't think the jury would have known about that. They would have just had to concentrate on the murder trial.
By the way, if you work with someone and you've nicknamed her the Black Widow, and then her husband dies in apparently mysterious circumstances, wouldn't you pick up the phone and tell the police about it?
Yeah, you'd think so. Well, you definitely wouldn't be eating those muffins at morning tea, would you? But, yeah, I think that's why when Leanne Cartier came phoning, they were pretty quick to spill the beans on her, you know, especially when... a family member has concerns that not all was well and that there might have been foul play then. And fair play to those workmates. They did turn up at court and, you know, in a pretty stressful situation and give evidence against Milner, which did lead to her being guilty and getting 17 years minimum in jail.
What struck you about watching her in the dock?
Yeah, it was a fascinating watch in a lot of ways. I mean, she could be anyone's mum. She just the sort of conservative, middle-aged woman with glasses. Some people cruelly joked she looked a little bit like Mrs. Doubtfire. But sitting there in court, she didn't give much away. And, you know, every day we'd have this explosive evidence, and Mr. Nisbet's family and friends sitting in the back of the court, you know, just a few metres away. It was, she never engaged with them or looked at them very much. But It was just this unassuming figure. How could this person go to such cold-blooded lengths to get away from someone she didn't like?
You never saw flashes of that woman who had yelled at you when you first showed up at her house a couple of years earlier?
Oh, it was sort of one of those ones where you might get a glint in the eye, perhaps, when a certain piece of evidence came up, especially when Leanne Cartier took the stand. That was some pretty tense scenes. You know, they're only a few metres away. And Cartier had got into Milner's tight circle there, and here she was accusing her of murder. So there were certainly flashes there where you could see she was particularly angry.
How did the police approach the suicide notes at the trial?
Yeah, that was pretty fascinating. So I don't think that they looked at them very hard in the first investigation. They obviously did in the second. And during the trial, I think there was evidence of up to 4 suicide notes at one point, which was kind of ridiculous. They were, the Crown said they were plainly faked, and this was Milner trying to cover her tracks.
Had they not done handwriting testing in the first investigation?
No, it doesn't appear so. It looks like that those detectives in the first investigation looked at it straight away and thought it was a straight up and down suicide, and that was the problem. You know, they should have gone in there and at least looked at it as a suspicious death, if not a homicide, and then worked back from there. It's a lot easier to work back than to ramp it up from a suicide.
Was it a jury trial?
Yep, that's right, absolutely. Every murder in New Zealand's a jury trial. I can't remember the makeup of men and women, but it did take them some time to come to their final conclusions. I think that was more to do with there was a couple of attempted murder charges as well, where it was suggested that she had tried to kill him earlier. They didn't manage to reach guilty verdicts on that, but on the main charge, the one of murder, they were unanimous.
Okay, and she was found guilty, and what happened next?
Well, within hours of her being found guilty, the cops told me, in fact, the senior investigations manager, Detective Inspector Tom Fitzgerald, straight after the guilty verdict came back, he told me that he admitted that the investigation, the first one, was badly flawed. It wasn't treated as a homicide, and that was a major mistake. So straight away, they put their hands up, and those officers in charge of the first investigation, they were dragged over the coals for it internally.
And you mentioned earlier she was sentenced to 17 years, but the story isn't over yet, Kurt.
Yeah, it really is one of those ones. It's just rumbled on and on. So she appealed against her sentence and conviction, failed, and she's maintained her innocence throughout, I must say. But now she's also trying to... she's not given up, even though her avenues of appeal seem to have been extinguished. The Court of Appeal has recently decided that Milner had applied to get further scientific testing of her dead husband's body parts, and the Court of Appeal has just granted that, much to the fury of his family, and in particular Leanne Cartier.
Yeah, so why does she want these samples?
Well, she reckons that it'll back her case that she's innocent. The body samples are held by the ESR, the government institute that does the forensic scientific testing for the likes of the police in New Zealand. And she hopes that the test results will show that she's innocent and could support an application to the Governor-General for an exercise of the royal prerogative of mercy, which gives a special avenue for criminal cases to be reopened where a person may have been wrongly convicted or sentenced.
You've come across that a few times. What's been the Nisbet family's reaction to this request for samples, and in fact, you know, her being granted access to these samples?
Well, they fought against it in court, and when the Court of Appeal came back and said that they'd ruled in favour of Milner to at least have that testing done, Cartier felt it was a huge blow. They felt it was completely outrageous and unfounded, another unfounded goose chase. And also, they were disappointed that a convicted murderer had won this, and also the fact that, you know, Phil's last human remains are going to be disturbed again. I think that was something that really upset them. And it just, as you said, the case goes on and on. You know, where does it end?
Disturbed again by the person found to have murdered him. They also noted that it might open the floodgates for other convicts wanting to make similar requests. Kurt, how will you remember this case? What is it about it that's been most memorable for you?
I think the poisoning aspect is something that fascinates. You know, it's sort of a plot out of Sherlock Holmes or something like that, isn't it? And the fact that she nearly got away with it, you know, and for a while there she must have thought she had. And that's one thing that Cartier always sort of told me, that, you know, she used to get so wild that Milner looked so smug and she thought she was cleverer than everybody else. So I think it's the fact that it had so many different aspects to it, you know, the poisoning, the botched police case, these allegations of hitmen running around, and it just, yeah, had everything.
Thanks for listening to Crimes NZ. I'm Jesse Mulligan. You can catch more of me every afternoon on RNZ National around 101 FM in New Zealand, or listen to the show live at rnz.co.nz. If you're looking for another podcast, don't go past the RNZ Podcasts page on our website. You'll find news podcasts like the award-winning The Detail, human interest podcasts like Generation COVID, and much more too. All of our podcasts are on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.